Nimrod's people pronounced the name of their empire Babilu, which meant the gates of the gods. And it just so happened that the name sounded very similar to the Hebrew word for confusion. I find that funny. In naming their state system something that to them sounded lofty and inspiring and divine, they ended up giving it a name that indicated chaos and disorganization to the Hebrew peoples. I don't think that was an accident, given God's way of doing things. But that carries over to all human attempts to play God. They claim to be bringing order when they establish their governments, but in the end, it always leads to disarray on a multitude of levels. Man isn't nearly as smart or clever as he likes to imagine he is. And you could have said the exact same thing about Nebuchadnezzar, the emperor of Babylon in the days of Daniel, somewhere around 2,000 years after Nimrod. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, he had a lot of reasons to pat himself on the back. His fathers before him had managed to put Babylon on the map as a force to be reckoned with, but he had managed to bring it back to its former glory as the world's foremost superpower. He'd defeated Egypt and ended their power, and expanded Babylon's influence throughout the known world. And here's another thing that's interesting. In the 1800s, the British archaeologist Henry Rawlinson discovered a cache of clay cylinders. These cylinders were engraved with writing so they could be rolled onto wet clay tablets and imprint the writing on the clay. One of them says something very interesting. It says, "I am Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. My great lord has established me in strength and has urged me to repair his buildings. The Tower of Babylon I have made and finished. The Tower of Borsippa had been built by a former king. He had completed 42, possibly cubits. But he did not finish its head. From the lapse of time, it had become ruined. The rain and wet had penetrated into the brickwork. The casing of burnt brick had bulged out. Marduk, my great lord, inclined my heart to repair the building. I did not change its site, nor did I destroy its foundation platform. But in a fortunate month, and upon an auspicious day, I undertook the rebuilding. I set my hand to build it up and to finish its summit. As it had been in ancient times, so I built up its structure." Another translator of the cylinder worded a few lines of the text a bit differently. "The most ancient monument of Babylon. I built and finished it. A former king built it. They reckon 42 ages ago, but he did not complete its head. Since a remote time, people had abandoned it without order expressing their words." Yeah, so apparently, Nebuchadnezzar took it upon himself to rebuild and finish the Tower of Babel, or the Tower of Babylon, as it's worded on the cylinder. He'd achieved what Nimrod himself had failed to do. Now, why God allowed him to finish it, I can only guess. But I'm thinking it may have been because God was letting Nebuchadnezzar get really high on himself, giving him plenty of that pride rope to hang himself with. Because we know from reading Daniel that God really humbled him, at least enough for Nebuchadnezzar to recognize that there was indeed a divine king and it wasn't him. By the time we catch up to Nebuchadnezzar in the book of Daniel, he had accomplished a lot, including destroying Jerusalem along with its temple, which was not only the central hub of Judean culture, but also qualified as one of the wonders of the world. In doing so, he likely figured he'd defeated not just the Judeans, but also their God. As far as he was concerned, he'd made it. He'd done exactly what is described in Isaiah 14, ascended to heaven and made himself like the Most High, or so he thought. So naturally, he was pretty upset to have a dream that affected him profoundly and yet couldn't remember it. In those days, everyone put way more stock in dreams than we do today, and so, with so much on the line, Nebuchadnezzar very understandably wanted to dig it back up and have it interpreted. Did it bother him because it meant his life was in danger or that his kingdom was facing a new threat? He didn't know. But he felt that he had to know. So no wonder he got so upset when his professional charlatans couldn't tell him what the dream even was. But God gave the dream to Daniel, as we all know, and Daniel told Nebuchadnezzar the dream. Let's read what Daniel told him in Daniel 2, verses 31 through 35. You, O king, were looking, and behold, there was a single great statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was awesome. The head of that statue was made of fine gold, its breast and its arms of silver, its belly and its thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You continued looking until a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed all at the same time, and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, so that not a trace of them was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain, and filled the whole earth. Daniel goes on to explain that the head of gold is you, O king, referring to Nebuchadnezzar. He reigned during Babylon's absolute peak, its golden age, if you will. He represented the peak of Babylonian power and glory and achievement. He outshone Nimrod himself. He was a big deal as far as Babylon was concerned. The breast and arms of silver represented the allied kingdoms of Media under Darius and Persia under Cyrus, which, as we know, conquered Babylon in Daniel's time. The belly and thighs of bronze represented the Grecian Empire under Alexander the Great and his generals, which, as we know, conquered Persia. And the legs of iron represented Imperial Rome, which in turn conquered the fragmented Greek Empire. The feet of iron and clay I'd like to get into more detail on later, because there's a lot of controversy over it, but suffice to say that it's marked by so much dross and lost so much strength and integrity that it's pretty much a joke compared to the previous empires. Now, let's talk about this image for a bit. Starting at the top and working your way down, each empire is represented by less dense, less valuable metals, ending with a weird, unstable mixture. So right away, we note three things. It's top-heavy, its foundation is very shaky, and as you progress, it loses value and integrity. But the fact that the golden head represents Babylon also tells us something else. The head is the seat of consciousness. It's the center of the nervous system. Without the head, the rest of the body is dead. The head animates the rest of the body. So what we're seeing is this succession of empires given life and action and purpose by the original empire, Babylon. They're indwelt by Babylon's spirit. So really, when you look at literally any one of these empires represented in that image, you are in fact looking at extensions of Babylon. Medo-Persia was Babylonian in nature. Greece was Babylonian in nature. Rome was Babylonian in nature. I mean, think about it. If you see my arm or my foot, you're seeing me. It doesn't matter if you're looking at my head. Because they're all attached to my head, you are in fact looking at me. So no matter which empire represented in that image we might be talking about, we're ultimately talking about the governmental and religious entity called Babylon, the rebellious and blasphemous and self-worshipping system established by Nimrod all the way back in Genesis. To reinforce this, think about Jesus Christ. He's the head of his body, as we read in Ephesians 5, verse 23, which says, "For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body." Now, just stop and think about this for a moment. Nebuchadnezzar and his Babylon are the head of this imperial governmental image, infusing it with his spirit and mission and pride and rebellion against God. And so when we see Christ being described as the head of his church, the Greek word for church is ekklesia, by the way, which is a governmental term, and we read that he has indwelt his people with his spirit, we start to see a distinct parallel. History is just the story of the body of man, the body of Babylon, versus the body of Christ. We're looking at two bodies slugging it out in the ring of world history. Going back to the image in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, as you get down to the legs and feet, you reach the parts of the body that take it places, that make it possible to go where it hadn't been able to go before. Legs and feet indicate mobility. If the Babylonian, Medo-Persian, and Greek empires thought they'd had a lot of influence on the world, they hadn't seen anything yet. Rome took many of the practices and technologies and the religions and philosophies and languages of the previous empires, along with their own, and spread them throughout the world using a road network like the world had never seen before, and left an imprint on the world culturally and politically and religiously like nobody else. Whereas the previous empires had created and nurtured and incubated the idea of empire and world influence and dominance, Rome took it and, well, it ran with it. But ultimately, here's the thing about it. All these empires, all these ideas, all this power, it's just an image. It's an image of a man, but not a real man. Just like idol worshippers weren't really bowing to Baal or Moloch or Marduk or Ishtar, but were only bowing to images of these entities. They existed, in fact, only in the worshippers' minds. Nebuchadnezzar was dreaming of an image, an idol. In fact, the word translated image in Daniel 2 is the same word used to describe the idols and images used in idolatrous worship. In the Greek Septuagint, the word is icon, from which we derive the word icon. That's right, as in the icons used in Greek Orthodox or Roman Catholic worship. And what's more, the image was of a man. Babylon represents the worship of man, humanism. Wherever you find humanistic thought and practice, you have found the spirit of Babylon. And it's not only alive and well today, but it has spread all over the face of the earth in a way that Nimrod and Nebuchadnezzar could never have imagined. But as we read in Daniel 2, verses 34 through 35, "You continued looking until a stone was cut without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed all at the same time, and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth." And Daniel explains this in verses 44 through 45. "In the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed, and that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush and put an end to all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure forever. Inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. So the dream is true, and its interpretation is trustworthy." The day will come when not just one empire in a succession of empires is destroyed. Christ's eternal kingdom will completely obliterate them, and not a trace of them will be found. they'll be nothing more than old history. Nemrod's dream will never find so much as a foothold ever again. In the next segment, we'll explore in detail how Babylon is alive and well today in the form of the state and everything else attached to it.